It's really wonderful to have Jonathan Weber here and his wife, Connie. And I'm not going to introduce them, but my colleague, Shana Penn, who's a visiting scholar at CJS and who works on material that's a little closer to what Jonathan does, will introduce him.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm Shana Penn, and I'm a visiting scholar here at GTU. It's a real privilege for me to be able to welcome Jonathan Weber to our GTU Center for Jewish Studies community, and to be able to introduce you to a scholar and activist who has led many important efforts to understand, shape, and reconstruct Jewish identity, culture, and material heritage in post-Cold War Europe for several generations now. Jonathan was born in London and graduated from University College London with a degree in anthropology and linguistics before earning a doctorate in social anthropology at Oxford. His interests include Polish-Jewish relations, museum studies, and research into the remains of Jewish landmarks and monuments in southern Poland in the Galicia region. Jonathan taught for many years at Oxford University before moving in 2002 to the University of Birmingham, where he held the UNESCO Chair in Jewish and Interfaith Studies through 2010. This year, Jonathan begins a new professorship at the European Studies Center at Jagiellonian University in Krakow, the oldest university in Central Europe, and one of the first universities, indeed the first university in East Central Europe to develop a Jewish studies program, which was in 1986. It was also the first Jewish studies program in Poland. Jonathan taught for many years at Oxford. Jonathan's strong interest in Polish-Jewish relations and Polish-Jewish studies has helped to develop the field. He has been a member of the International Council of the Auschwitz State Museum since its founding in 1990, and is vice chairman of the Institute for Polish-Jewish Studies, which was established in Oxford in 1984. He's participated in numerous projects realized in cooperation between the Oxford Center for Hebrew and Jewish Studies, the University of Oldenburg, Jagiellonian, and the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. Since 1990, he was a member of the board of the Center for Information, Meetings, Dialogue, and Education in Oświęcim. He's also been a member of the Auschwitz Jewish Center Foundation since 1998, and told me very proudly that he was one of its major fundraisers. He was a member of the honorary committee of the International Conference commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and has organized and chaired four international conferences on the future of Oświęcim, which is the small city neighboring Auschwitz. The author of numerous scholarly books, collected volumes, and articles, two of my favorites include the edited volume, Jewish Identities in the New Europe, and The Future of Auschwitz, Some Personal Reflections. Jonathan is co-author with the late Chris Schwartz of the permanent exhibition Traces of Memory at the Galicia Jewish Museum in Krakow, which was established in 2004. And he's also author of his companion volume, Rediscovering Traces of Memory, The Jewish Heritage of Polish Galicia, and that was published in 2009. A traveling version of this exhibition is now at Pepperdine University in Southern California through April 25th, if anyone has a chance to see it. And it's the reason for Jonathan's visit to California. Over a period of 12 years, Jonathan and Chris Schwartz, the photographer, worked together to document in photos, testimony, and text the Jewish sites that were destroyed in Poland, and to offer a completely new way of looking at the Polish Jewish past through a contemporary lens. The exhibition pieces together a picture of the relics of Jewish life and culture in Galicia that can still be seen today, interpreting these traces in a manner which is informative and accessible. This project's message is to remember the past, to remember the past is to shape the future and give it some sense of direction. In 1999, Jonathan was awarded the Gold Cross of the Order of Merit by the President of the Republic of Poland for his contribution to the Polish-Jewish dialogue and Polish-Jewish relations. In 2009, he was awarded an honor medal of the Ministry of Culture and National Heritage of the Republic of Poland for his services to Polish culture. Today's lecture on Auschwitz-Birkenau is timely in light of the Saturday's New York Times article on the front page about the Auschwitz State Museum and its plans to meet the 21st century educational needs of its visitorship, a visitorship which has grown or quadrupled over the last 4 years from about 250,000 to this past year, 1.38 million people. Most of the visitors today are predominantly not Jewish or nor do they have ties to the Holocaust. Before I turn the podium over to Jonathan, I'd also like to recognize Connie Weber, who is managing editor of Littman Library of Jewish Civilization, which is the preeminent Jewish studies publishing house based in London, and Jonathan's life partner. So Jonathan, witam.
Well, what an introduction. What an introduction. Goodness, I don't know why you don't carry on for another 2 hours, you see.
you can take me with you on the road.
That is wonderful. And let me just correct one detail. You said I'm here because of Pepperdine University. Yes, that is literally true. But I'm here in Southern California because I want to be here in the GTU. I have to say that whatever it is that Shana has just told you about me, the truth is you missed out one very important thing. I am, and I feel, a village boy, like a village boy coming to the big town and being overwhelmed by the bright lights of the city. This place, GTU, University of California at Berkeley, and the Graduate Theological Union, this is the heartland, this is the center, and I just come from a little offshore island known as England, fancies itself as the United Kingdom. I mean, really, I mean, goodness, the disunited kingdom would be a better way of describing it. I have to say that the GTU is a place I've heard about. I come from a UNESCO chair in interfaith studies, but our place, the epicenter of interfaith studies, that's the GTU. And, you know, for me to stand before you here, a Center for Jewish Studies at the GTU, what a wonderful privilege, and I'm terribly grateful for the invitation to Naomi, wherever she is, I saw her there. To Naomi Seidman for the invitation, to Shana Penn for the invitation, for the facilitation of these invitations, to Pepperdine, I have a whole list, yes, Pepperdine University for hosting the Traces of Memory exhibition. I'm supposed to, you know, to wave this at you, and somewhere or other I've got flyers where you can order extremely expensive copies at twice the price of what you pay on Amazon, or half the price, whatever you pay, I don't know. But really, I have to tell you, it's a wonderful thing to be here. This is a beautiful place. It reminds me of my club, of my Oxford College. It's charming, it's lovely, and I'm sure you have had many memorable events here and will have many memorable events here. Whether today's event will be memorable, that's not for me to say. I have a difficult subject to talk about. What I want to start off by telling you is it is not... I'm going to tell you what I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to take you on a guided tour. What you will see when you get off your tour bus and you walk around Auschwitz for your statutory 2 hours and a half or 3 hours and a half, or I've taken students there for a whole week, I'm not going to do that. I want to do something a bit more analytical and try to give you a sense of the problematic of present-day Auschwitz in a way which I hope will be accessible. So what I'm going to do is show you a lot of photographs. These were taken by Chris Schwartz, the photographer who I worked with to produce this book that you've heard about now four times already, and who's really outstanding. Unfortunately, he's in the Garden of Eden right now. He's enjoying himself in eternal bliss. He passed away about 4 or 5 years ago, but his museum lives on, his legacy lives on. I will show you a lot of pictures of him, about 50 photographs. I won't spend too long on the photographs, and then I'd like to say a few more theoretical thoughts about Auschwitz. It's not exactly an uplifting subject. It's a very challenging and complicated subject, so I apologize in advance. I also want to say that one other thing I'm not going to do is I'm not going to resort to tear-jerking emotions. I'm going to speak plainly about Auschwitz as a as a reality which exists and which our generation has to deal with. Yes, of course, every inch of Auschwitz is tear-jerking and is emotional, but that's not going to be the star of my presentation this morning. And for that, for those of you who think that the only way to speak about Auschwitz is in that mode, then I, for that, I apologise. Not because I'm incapable of speaking in that way. I'm perfectly capable, I think, of getting you all to sit there and start crying. But that's not really what I feel I came here today for. So I apologise, if you like, for that, speaking about it in a matter-of-fact, analytical, intellectual way. Auschwitz became a death camp. Let me just review the brief historical outline. It became a death camp for Jews in March 1942. I'm sorry, it became a death camp for Jews in March 1942 after it had already been an internment camp for Polish political prisoners for nearly 2 years. So from a Polish point of view, it started as a Polish camp. Then it became an international and largely Jewish camp, nearly two years later. The main gas chambers in Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is a sub-camp of Auschwitz, about 2 miles away from the original camp, or Stammlager, opened in the spring of 1943. So the actual functioning of the gas chambers was only about 18 months. It stopped, the gas chambers ceased functioning in the autumn of 1944. The camp was liberated in January 1945 by the Red Army, Mr. Stalin's brigades. By the time that the camp was liberated in January 1945, about 1 million Jews had been murdered in Auschwitz, of whom 40% were from Hungary. They arrived in the spring and early summer of 1944. The other 60% came from just about every occupied country in Europe, including Jews from Norway in the north and the Greek islands in the south. Auschwitz was the largest German concentration camp and the single largest place of Jewish victimhood during the Holocaust. But of course, at 1 million, it's only one-sixth of the 6 million. So lots of other places too, but this talk is only today about Auschwitz itself. Auschwitz was the most international, and there are many testimonies about it because they had probably about 200,000 people who survived. That's because Auschwitz included a very large labor camp, and if you were selected with being strong enough, young enough, and healthy enough to be selected by the German doctors to supply labor for the German war economy, then you were sent to the labor camp, and then you had a small chance of survival. Statistically, about 15% of everyone who entered Auschwitz survived the war. Hence, a lot of testimonies about Auschwitz and why Auschwitz became so terribly well known. Most famous, perhaps, is the Italian Jew Primo Levi, and the Hungarian or the Transylvanian Jew, Elie Wiesel. In addition to about 1 million Jewish deaths, we say about because not every person who arrived there was in fact registered, despite tremendous German bureaucracy and systematic nature of how they ran the place. In addition to about 1 million Jewish deaths, we have to note that accounts for only about 92% of the total, the overwhelming majority, but there is still another 8% which need to be added in, including 75,000 ethnic Poles, 75,000 ethnic Poles making Auschwitz the largest Polish cemetery in the country, 20,000 gypsies, 15,000 Soviet prisoners of war, as well as other groups of petty German criminals, homosexuals, and Jehovah's Witnesses. What this lecture is about is the relationship between the Holocaust as a historical event and what's been left behind and what can still be seen at the actual site of Auschwitz. What I want to try and do is to deconstruct the nature of what the present-day visitor actually sees of Auschwitz. Given the importance of the place as the largest single site where the Holocaust took place, the question of just how and in what way present-day Auschwitz can suitably symbolize the Holocaust, as is often said, or act as a representation of it, is therefore a rather important and even fundamental issue. It's a very complicated place, and it has a very complex memory, and the challenge for our generation is really what to do with the place, what should be done, what can be done, what needs to be done there, and so on. This photograph you see in front of you is not from Auschwitz. It's from another camp altogether. It's about 250 miles east of Auschwitz, and it's the place known as Belzec. Not to be confused with Bergen-Belsen, which is another camp altogether in northern Germany. Belzec, in what is now southeastern Europe, was the third largest death camp for Jews during the Holocaust, Auschwitz being the first at about 1 million deaths, Treblinka being the second at about 750,000 or 800,000 deaths, and Belzec at number three at around 450,000 or 475,000. Now, the interesting difference between Belzec and Auschwitz is that there is nothing left at Belzec whatever. The whole killing of 500,000 Jews was done in about 9 or 10 months during the year 1942, and when that task had been completed, the Germans demolished everything, all the watchtowers, all the barracks, all the barbed wire, and destroyed every sign that ever had been mass murder at the place. Nothing left there at all. Now, in 2004, the American Jewish Committee put up a very brand new monument there, which I'm not going to show you today. This subject is so large, I can only scratch the surface. We'd be here till supper time, 6 p.m., 8 p.m., 10 p.m., if I was to try to tell you everything that needs to be said, let alone everything that I could say. But I just wanted to start off with this picture of Belzec because it contrasts very strongly, of course, with that. There are problems that the visitor to Auschwitz is so fixed on what there is and the clutter of what's left behind that by focusing on this Arbeit macht frei, on the gates, on the barracks, you're focusing on what's there rather than on the nothingness of what was. I mean, how are you as a visitor to an authentic Holocaust site different from visiting Belzec, as it was at least before the new monument was put there, as opposed to visiting Auschwitz? That's a question. I'm incidentally not going to have time to do more than ask questions today, not to offer you cheap, simple, formulaic answers. But it's an important question. When I bring my students to Auschwitz, what I always do is take them first to Belzec. And what I did just now is to take you to Belzec through the medium of a photograph before we look at Auschwitz. Is the sheer physicality of Auschwitz telling us how to interpret the site, or is it, in a sense, misleading us because we're too focused, perhaps, it's a question, not a statement, on the physicality of what's been left behind rather than on the nothingness that there is in Belzec? I'm going to divide my remarks about these photographs into two parts. The first part I want to show you is when you go to what is left behind in Auschwitz today falls into two categories. Things which roughly, very roughly, are as they were during the war, and things which really, very roughly, were not. So what we're looking at here is something which was there during the war. This is the entry to Auschwitz Stammlager, Auschwitz number one. Arbeit macht frei, work makes you free, a cynical slogan which you have at virtually every Nazi concentration camp, not just Auschwitz. And as you know, the sign was stolen by a bunch of neo-Nazis in Sweden not so long ago, and when that happened, a number of Jewish leaders stood up and said, "Oh, this is the symbol of the Holocaust." the symbol of the Holocaust. Well, all right, they're entitled to their opinions. I think the theft of Arbeit macht frei was not a nice thing to do, and so the museum has to make a copy of this, and now there is a copy up there, not an original, because the original I was sawn into three pieces, and we don't yet know how it's going to be stuck back together again, or if we keep the copy there and not the original. Incidentally, I say we, because I feel so very deeply involved with Auschwitz as a place. It became a museum in 1947, but never had a board. Never had a board until Weber came along in 1989, went to the Polish Prime Minister and said, don't you think we should have a board for the... And he said, what a good idea. And would you like to become a founding member of the board? I said, oh, that's very nice. So 20 years later, I'm still a member of that board. And we have a lot of discussions about all kinds of things that should be done there. So let me lead you into this subject by showing you a few things which, if you like, are still there, which were there during the war. First one of these is the pillbox, which is where the roll calls took place. All the prisoners were led out there and had to be counted very meticulously, morning and evening, make sure everybody was still present and correct in the best German way. The pillbox man there had to control all that. And in parentheses, let me just drop the thought into your mind now. Is that pillbox original? Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Complicated. There's no little... Sometimes you go to Greece and you see a little thing where they show you, you know, this ancient Greek temple, you know, the first 2 feet off the ground is original and the rest has been added by our competent archaeologists and art historians. There's nothing like that in Auschwitz. Well, of course, wood like that would rot. You can't leave wood like that out in a heavy Polish winter for 60 years and it's still expected to survive. Of course it's been restored. They've used old bits of wood, but more or less they've done it faithfully and they've relied on wartime photographs and it's been very carefully restored. Is it a copy? No. Is it an original? No. What is it? Well, I leave that for you to decide. It's complicated. Are the barracks original? Yes. Have they been restored? Yes. Have they used original bricks to restore the barracks? Yes. But if you start to bring your microscope out and start looking at things, they've done all kinds of things which a present-day conservationist would turn his or her nose up at, because the standards of conservation have changed a lot in these 60 years, and you have to remember that this whole place was built provisionally for a particular military or, shall we say, genocidal purpose, and it wasn't intended to last, like Gothic cathedrals were intended to last for centuries. So the whole conservation strategy, philosophy, and technology had to be invented on the spot. This is, of course, the entry gate to Birkenau. I said there were 40, Auschwitz had 40 sub-camps. Birkenau was number two. Some people don't get confused whether it's Auschwitz or Auschwitz-Birkenau, whether it's just Birkenau. The Germans called it Auschwitz hyphen, with a hyphen, Birkenau. Which means a sub-camp of Birkenau. So number three, which was Monowitz, would be Auschwitz hyphen Monowitz, or Monowice in Polish. This is the entry gate to Auschwitz II Birkenau, in quite good condition, actually. It never had a sign up saying Arbeit macht frei. You can actually read quite a lot of Holocaust memoirs, which tell you they got off the train, walked for a mile, and passed a sign saying, Arbeit macht frei, and entered Auschwitz-Birkenau. Well, those survivors may well have been influenced by books they've read or films they've seen. As far as we know, there never was an Arbeit macht frei sign here, even though Birkenau was intended as a massive labor camp which was supposed to accommodate anything up to 100,000 people. It was a major city. Here you can get a sense of its size. This is only, for those of you who've never been to Auschwitz, this is only probably, I would say, about 20% of the size of the camp. I mean, it's a really just a small, maybe even less than 20%, what you can see in this picture. The wooden barracks in the foreground were stables for horses, which were improvised to house prisoners who had just arrived to Auschwitz. It was an area known as quarantine, and they've been meticulously restored in the last 20 years. The chimneys which are in the background there are nothing sinister. They belong to the heating system of the brick barracks which lay beyond. And if you really look carefully at the top left-hand corner of this picture, you can see a half barrack. And those of you who are interested to know, that none of the guides will ever tell you this, there's a half barrack there. And why is there only a half barrack there? It's literally half the length of the others. And the reason is that where is the other half of the barrack? Yes, you guessed it. It's in the United States, Washington, D.C., Holocaust Memorial Museum. They wanted something authentic to show the visitors. So they came along to Auschwitz and said, we'd like to have a barrack, please. And the Auschwitz Museum people said, no, you can't. We are obliged under law to preserve everything that we have. You cannot do it. So they may have said, well, what if we offered to, you know, contribute a small sum of money to help you with some of your things? And they said, well, nah. Eventually, they agreed to cut the barrack in half, left the half there, and took the other half to Washington. You can see it if you go there. It's quite interesting. But anyway, there it is. But otherwise, yes, these are original, quite original barracks, being restored and conserved. What is the theory and the philosophy behind conservation? Well, as I'm very interested in this whole question, is it to be preserved for the next 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, 500 years? You have to get your objectives clearly in mind, because if you need a technology or a methodology, you need to know what you're trying to achieve. Who knows? As I said, I'm coming with the questions rather than the answers. You can cross-examine me a bit more if you want to later on. Excellent photography. Some of the photographs are a bit sentimental, perhaps, but they're good. This is probably how it might have looked on an ordinary winter's day. The sub-camps of Birkenau being screened off, electrified wire fences. If you manage to get out of one sub-camp and want to talk to your wife in the other sub-camp, you might have a hell of a job to do that, because you can see, the moment you step out of your sub-camp, there's a guy up there in the watchtower who is not going to be amused by your attempt just to wander about between the sub-camps. Yes. Here you can see a typical sub-camp. The central building is a standard brick-built prisoner barrack. The right-hand building is the kitchen barrack. The prisoners did get food, not a lot of it, not very nourishing, not very tasty, and not enough to go around, but there was food. Why? Because in Germany, you know, there was the Ordnung muss sein, there has to be rules and regulations, and in a concentration camp, the prisoners have to be fed. It doesn't never said how much they have to be fed, but there's a kitchen there. The building on the left-hand side is neither a kitchen nor is it a prisoner barrack. It is a latrine where the prisoners can spend 30 seconds in the morning over a hole in the ground and 30 seconds in the evening over this hole in the ground, and that's their lot for the day. And if you leaked during the day, well, it depends on the guard and his attitude towards you. He could beat you, shoot you, or he could turn the other way. It depended. Luck, divine protection, who knows? So three types of building there. Actually, quite well preserved, as you can see. Gives a good idea of the way in which life, if you like, for the prisoners was organized. Yes. Okay. There's a blow-up of the quarantine section with the restored barracks. I mentioned the barbed wire here because a lot of people come back and they brought their wire clippers and they say, I've got, you know, 6 inches of Auschwitz barbed wire as my souvenir of the visit. Well, maybe they did get it in Auschwitz, but of course it would not be original wartime barbed wire. You see, the problem about barbed wire is it rusts, and you keep it up there throughout the winters for 65 years, there's going to be nothing left. So this barbed wire is all replaced. So I'm showing you that it's problematic. This is how the camp was. This is the wartime reality. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. The barbed wire is brand new. People want to see barbed wire. I mean, it's very important for people to see barbed wire. They come to Auschwitz, come all the way from Australia to see Auschwitz, all the way from California to Auschwitz. They've got to see barbed wire and watchtowers, and they've got to take pictures, you know, photographs of this thing. Now, as for the concrete posts, are they original? Very interesting question. There's no technology known how to restore concrete posts, but we commissioned a study, and we came up with a technology to restore concrete posts, because if you don't have the concrete posts restored, the barbed wire ain't going to stay up there very long. So, the concrete posts. But they're pretty good copies or restored originals. The wire, just in case any of you were wondering, is today not electrified. You can touch the wire and you will not be electrocuted. So therefore, what is like there today is not precisely as it was then, nor, I hasten to add, there's a lot of grass there if it wasn't covered in snow, but there was no grass there. People plucked the grass and ate it. They were rather hungry and they couldn't eat anything they could find. Inside a quarantine barrack, you can see stabling for horses, requisition for prison. Why did they use this horse's stable architecture? Because the whole, I'm not a historian. I have to be very careful what I say in front of historians. Some people say that Auschwitz was never intended for what it later became. And there's this whole discussion between intentionists, you know, and functionalists. Did Hitler intend it from the start, or did it evolve? Well, the whole business about the history of Auschwitz shows an enormous number of arguments in favor of the functionalist point of view. Auschwitz evolved. That's a two-hour lecture, which I cannot give you today. What is the evidence from Auschwitz for the functionalist point of view? But I can allude to the fact that they didn't have any of their plans in position, so they had to use architectural designs for some other area of their wartime economy, namely stabling for horses. And horses, very important in World War II, because they didn't have fuel enough and they didn't have everything militarized enough. It was horses were pulling the heavy loads, so they just put up these stables and then tossed in these three-tier bunks and said, this is a prisoner barrack. Okay. The railway. Very important. The Holocaust cannot be understood without railways. Raoul Hilberg, Oliver Solom, I think. He said that you cannot understand the Holocaust without looking at railway timetables, where the trains were coming from, how they were scheduled, the use of rolling stock. Railways are absolutely critical here. As you can see, the railway leading straight inside the camp. Here is an example of functionalist development of Auschwitz. That railway spur in Birkenau, as you can tell from the guardhouse at the back there, was added only in 1944. So quite late. Birkenau had existed for at least a year before that railway spur was there, because the Germans in March invaded Hungary. And according to all their sources, the Jews of Hungary were going to be a rich catchment area, 700,000 to be murdered in their final solution program. And the decision was taken to bring the whole lot to Auschwitz. They got 450 to Auschwitz, 450,000 that is, brought them by train. That's why the Auschwitz victims, 40% of them are Hungarian. Such a colossal amount. So they brought the spur right into the camp, and it's at the end of the railway line, maybe 100 yards from behind where the photograph is taken, that the gas chambers were located. So you were brought to the door. You didn't have to walk very far in order to get murdered. This was, of course, people were brought in families, and so therefore those who were selected by the doctors on this track on the right-hand side of the photograph, selected for the labor camp, this would be in the place they would have last have seen their mothers, their fathers, their uncles, their aunties, their children, their pregnant wives. Pregnant wives was a dangerous thing to do, to come to Auschwitz, obviously. They were not interested in pregnant women. So this is a place of tremendous emotional importance for survivors. And it's referred to a lot in the memoir literature. A gas chamber. I had the job of putting a caption to this photograph in the museum, and I thought, what caption do I give this picture? This is been restored. It's another story, but it is the original gas chamber in Stammlager, not in Birkenau. We'll come to Birkenau once in a moment. So I found this following passage in a book written by Raphael Scharf, a Polish Jew who used to live in London, whom we were all very fond of. He died a few years ago. And he wrote in another context entirely. This is what he wrote, and I decided to use that text for the caption for this picture. It's in the book. Mummy, when they kill us, will it hurt? No, my dearest, it will not hurt. It will take only a minute. Raphael Scharf says, yes, it took only a minute, but it is enough to keep us awake until the end of time. That's my caption to this photograph. Nothing much more to say. Well, there's a lot to say, but okay. The bodies were then cremated, following standard German military custom, and in fact, we should be aware that cremation was very popular in 19th century Germany. And so there was not this sense of horror about cremation that you get amongst Orthodox Jews or amongst Catholics even. It was absolutely standard. But they take the ashes and they would just simply dump them in the rivers, spread them on the fields, or in this case, just drop them into the nearest pond. This pond is not known precisely, but let's say about 50,000 people are in this pond in the middle of Birkenau. These are the pictures I wanted to show you of places in Auschwitz which really functioned during the wartime. Let's have a look at another aspect of this, Birkenau in ruins. You see, when the Germans realized the Soviet troops were very near and were about to attack them, of course, Berlin didn't want to tell them very clearly that they were losing the war. But news filtered through. The decision was taken to stop the gassings and to, in the autumn of 44, and to destroy the evidence of the crimes, as they had done in Belzec, as we saw a few minutes ago. However, the Soviet advance was much more rapid than high command really informed people, and so the destruction of the gas chambers didn't proceed really very successfully, and therefore what you've got today is ruins. Ruins of the gas chambers. Wow. Here, as part of the wartime realities of Auschwitz, you actually have the visual, clear architectural evidence of the attempt by the murderers to conceal the evidence of the crime. Of course, these ruins are terribly important. I mean, as part of the message of what this place is all about. That was the crematorium. This is the gas chamber, on one of the four gas chambers in Birkenau. Covered in snow. I think, for the sake of modesty, we covered it in snow. But for the sake of reality, you know, I got Chris to take a picture in summertime so you can see, but not the gas chamber. But we've got this one here. That's the undressing room. You can see the steps at the back. The people, everything was done underground. The people would be led down the steps into the undressing room. As you can see, from a conservation point of view, very difficult, because if you don't restore these brick supports, which are underground, the whole thing will fall in. Holocaust deniers have a lovely time coming along and saying, well, you're reconstructing Auschwitz. It's very problematic. I won't talk anything about steps. If you're interested in steps down into the undressing room, we can take them during questions. But let me just say that the existence of steps is part of the evidence from the functionalist point of view that Auschwitz, this was not built as a gas chamber. The architectural plan provided for a ramp, not steps, and as you know, the difference between a ramp and steps is that steps, you need to be alive to walk down the step, but a ramp, you can be dead, a corpse on a trolley of some kind and be wheeled down the ramp. Very interesting, but I'm not going to sidetrack myself into functionalism there, but still, the steps were there, used during the war for people to walk to their deaths, you see, down these steps. Right. Another kind of ruins, which are in Birkenau as well, are ruins which are there, I would say, not because of any intention from the Germans to destroy the evidence of the crime, but simply, we have to say, from the passage of time. I'm trying analytically to distinguish these categories. These are ruins which are created because of the passage of time. Here you can see no more barbed wire. This is a part of the camp that not many visitors actually see, so they can't be bothered to put the barbed wire back up again, but you can actually see from this photograph that barbed wire just disintegrates if you don't do anything. Here you can see the ruins of those brick barracks and the heating chimneys. And here a bit of close-up of the heating chimney, and our friend, the half barrack there in the distance, you see. This was ordinary heating chimneys to heat. If they didn't put any heating in at all, of course the heating was insufficient, not enough fuel, not a long enough time, but if you didn't put any heating in there at all, everybody just freezed to death in 20 minutes. So obviously you had to provide some heating to prevent that happening. After all, it was very important for the Germans to keep these people alive because it was business for them. You know that the Jews were being sent to these factories round about, and the factory owners would pay the SS per head so many Reichsmark per day, and the money would go not, of course, to the poor Jew who had to supply his labour, but, of course, to the coffers of the SS. The SS ran this as a business. So, obviously, they wanted their workers to be alive and rather than dead, even though they didn't feed them enough. But it didn't matter, because however many people dropped dead from exhaustion or from starvation or from hunger or whatever it might be, there were thousands and tens of thousands more folks whom they could ship in to take their places. I think that's the last of the ruins photographs, beautifully taken by Chris Schwartz, I'm sure you'll agree. There you have a ruin in the foreground and a fairly good, healthy-looking brick barrack in the background. Comes the question, do you want me to restore the barrack in the foreground so as to look like the barrack in the background, or do you want me to keep the barrack in the foreground as a contrast to the barrack in the background so that you can actually tell the story about the passage of time? A question, right? I'm not going to give you the answer to that, but you can see everything very problematic, very complicated. What are we doing it for anyway, you might ask? Why not let the whole place fall into the ground? That's a very interesting question, but I want to tackle that in this way. What did the existence of this site actually mean? Well, I don't know. I sat down and wrote out for you four propositions, very basic propositions. What do these places mean? Number one, it's important because by going there, you get a strong sense that the genocide actually happened there. Okay, it really was true. It happened. You get there and you get this. Very good. Secondly, by the sense of physical place helps people understand more about the realities. You walk along those railway lines and you get a sense of the terrified victims being led to their deaths and walking down those steps. I mean, you can develop an empathy for the victims. Fair enough. Thirdly, you can start thinking about how you want to commemorate them, and maybe you prepare a bunch of flowers, or you bring along some prayers, or the Book of Psalms, or observe a moment of respectful silence or whatever it might be. You develop perhaps a strategy to remember them. You don't do it in your daily round when you're sitting here in California, but when you're over there, you feel you ought to do something. Okay. Fourthly, there are inscriptions, monuments with inscriptions, and somehow maybe the inscriptions could move you and it could make a strong impression. Those are four simple propositions. None of them are any good at all. And because I want to be brief on this lecture, not keep you here until 10 p.m., I'm just going to give you very simple reasons why none of them are any good, even though they sound good. Okay, first proposition, to become awakened to the reality of the Holocaust. Well, problem with that is, sorry, Auschwitz is only a symbol. And if you want to get to the historical reality of what happened, you're confusing the symbol with the historical reality. And you're not going to get very far. If you only come once in a lifetime for one lousy day trip, how much are you going to learn about the Holocaust by coming to Auschwitz? You're going to stare at these visual exotica, as I've been talking about, comparing it with Belzec. You're focusing on what is there rather than meditating on what isn't there. Oh, and the nothingness which Auschwitz created. Maybe you should focus on the nothingness. Maybe Auschwitz, Belzec, is a better place. Maybe I'm asking the question. I keep saying, asking the question. Maybe you should focus on the nothingness and the incomprehensibility of genocide and the incomprehensibility of the Holocaust. Let's just have this picture back up again. Oh, yes. I mean, the nothingness may be helpful. I don't know. I'm only asking the question. Secondly, developing an empathy for the victims. Very nice. But if you focus on Auschwitz, you can't get very far either. Because you have to remember all the horrific experiences that the victims went through before they even set foot in Auschwitz. They were humiliated, they were discriminated against, they were ghettoized, there were random shootings, they had to suffer life in ghettos, whatever it might have been. Imprisonment, torture, being rounded up by the SS, watching your parents being hanged before your eyes, death from hunger or disease, even before you get there. You have this dreadful train ride, where they locked you inside with no toilet facilities, and you may have been on the train for a week, midsummer without water, midwinter without proper clothing, etc. So if you're coming to Auschwitz and you're getting an empathy, you're again missing, you're confusing the symbol with reality. Very problematic. Thirdly, personal relationship with the past, like saying prayers or lighting a candle. Yes, very nice. But actually, there are two things which need to be done in Auschwitz, and they don't often sit very well together. One is you need to think up commemorations. How am I going to mourn these guys? How am I going to remember them? What am I going to do about the victims? Am I seriously focusing on the victims? Or, which is what you usually get at a museum, you get bombarded with information. Information. People think that's all people want when they come to a museum is information. You know, you've got your headphones, you've got your guidebooks, you've got your guide speaking to you, people say, you know, how many people died in this gas chamber? How many people died in that gas chamber? How long was it? People ask how long, how big, how tall. Information. Okay, that's called education nowadays. Fine, okay. But how do you absorb all this information and do the other half, which is remembrance? And think about, forget about the information, but the people, like you and me, or those and them, who died and what you have to do to deal with that. Okay, fourth proposition, monuments. Not true that people will get a lot out of the inscriptions. Why is it not true? Because it depends on what kind of person you are. You see, as I've already said, 92% may have been Jewish, but there was all these Poles murdered there, and they're Roman Catholics. How are you going to have an inscription that's going to appeal to those guys? And what kind of inscription are you going to put on your monument that's going to be meaningful to a young German? I have to remember, an awful lot of Germans come there too. Rightly so. So you've got to have an inscription which is meaningful to Jews, and to Germans, and to Poles, and to Jehovah's Witnesses, and to Gypsies. You've got to have one inscription. What are you going to do? It's not very easy. Then you're going to have people who know a lot about the subject. Then you're going to have people who know nothing about the subject. You've got Christian pilgrims who are interested in the death of God, or whether God exists after Auschwitz. You've got religious Jews wondering whether God exists for them after Auschwitz. You've got Israeli groups coming on saying, we from Israel, you see, we have now got a Jewish state. It's a whole kind of different. How are you going to get an inscription that's going to appeal to all these people? The answer is some people will be simply turned off by what you tell them. Others are going to be, you know, indifferent at the very least. Who is responsible for this Holocaust? Was it God? Was it others? Are we also responsible? Was it them? Was Christianity at fault here? Or maybe Christianity was the victim? Maybe the real cause was secularization of society. Because only because when society is secularized, it's possible to treat people not in the image of God, which is how religious people are supposed to look at other people, but simply as cogs, as numbers, as units, as Stück, as they call them in German, pieces. Human beings were known as pieces, and of course they lost their names, got their number tattooed on their arm. Right? Secularization was the cause of it. Christianity was the victim, not the perpetrator. Very complicated subject, this. Oh. So, how much of all this should the museum tell people and deal with it? Very interesting question. Let me just put the question to you this way. If you're going to spend one day of your life visiting Auschwitz, how much time do you think you ought to spend listening to information, which you can get on the internet anyway, or from an encyclopedia, or from an instructor in a class? And how much time do you think you should spend sitting on the ground and meditating and being mournful and praying, to use the Jewish expression, to pray for the souls who hover there, who are murdered there? Normally, if you're a religious Jew and you go to a grave, let's say on the anniversary of the death, your job is to say a prayer for the soul of that person. It's your parent, let's say, your grandparent. Say a prayer because you believe somehow that soul somehow hovers at the place where buried or where died. So how much time should you do doing that? Most people spend zero. Some people will spend 2% at the very most of the time. I think, me, so I'm going to give you, for once, an opinion. I think spend 80% of the time there. If you went to Auschwitz and you spent 80% of your time just sitting on the ground meditating, and I think you'd come away from that place rather differently. That's my personal view, but I'll leave it at that. You may disagree, and that's fine. I'm just expressing a point of view. Right. Wartime history of Auschwitz, part one's finished. Post-war history of Auschwitz, I'll be very brief, and I've still got some conclusions, so I've got to rattle through all this lot. Post-war history. I've already said, Shane has already said, 1.4 million visitors per year. This is unbelievable. This is simply unbelievable. One of the most visited sites you've... And the figures are totally wacky. Now you've got tens of thousands of Japanese, Chinese, South Koreans, the newly wealthy East European Pacific Rim people, who've got no idea. Why were the Jews murdered? What was wrong with the Jews? You've got to start from this. I mean, how do you explain to all these people? Half of all the visitors are young people, which is very interesting. They're interested in all this. But there's so many people in Auschwitz, we count 500 people every 15 minutes in the middle of August. So it's very crowded, and this has caused major problems for the organization of the place. We've got to deal with VIPs. Bush came, and the President of France came, every Chancellor of Germany comes, Prime Minister of England. So many people come. You've got to look after them and give them a story. It's finance, very complicated. Can't charge. This is a cemetery. Can't charge people to get in. Yes, if you want to take a guide, then you should pay for a guide, but otherwise you can't charge. We've got to modernize the exhibitions. The exhibitions have been there for 50 years, and they relate to a communist period, and technology was very different, etc. Conservation I've spoken about a lot. So let me whiz through these pictures now. What's been happening to the place since 1945? An awful lot. So this is really, really, really just a tiny little view. I should just mention here now, coming back to this, when they conserved this gas chamber, they did it very clumsily. It was done in the 1950s, and without any sort of attention to detail that you'd now expect as normal. And the Auschwitz Museum now today finally admits it. I ran the first conservation conference in Auschwitz in 1993, and they were extremely embarrassed by all the questions we asked. Is this original? Is that original? Etc. And we finally got them, I got them, to put a sign outside this crematorium to admit, where it admits that it doesn't look quite the way it did, almost similar to the way it did in the war. But it's complicated. Nothing in Auschwitz is simple. This was not built as a gas chamber. It was built as an ammunition dump. And it was converted into a gas chamber. And after the gas chambers in Birkenau were brought into service in 1943, this was then, towards the end of the war, not used anymore. And so what they used it for was an air raid shelter. So to which level of reality, past reality, do you restore it back to? Former barracks have been converted in, a lot of the former barracks can be converted into museum spaces. Here is a collection of suitcases. These guys were deported there with suitcases and were told to bring their possessions. Very problematic, because nowadays you get some tourist in there and says, hey, that's my grandfather's suitcase, I want it. That raises all kinds of problems. I'll tell you more about that if you're interested. Shoes. It takes roughly... the Auschwitz Museum has got the best conservation laboratory now, one of the very best in Europe. It's being paid for by the Germans, a brilliant idea to us Germans to put in a very, very modern conservation lab. And indeed, they're conserving shoes at the rate of about 3 pairs a week. But if you realise they've got 150,000 pairs of shoes, they'll be at it for another 200 years or something. I don't know the math, but it's going to take them a long time. What do you do with these? How many shoes? What's your target once again? You want to conserve all the shoes, some of the shoes, which shoes, women's shoes, children's shoes, men's shoes, bourgeois shoes, workmen's shoes, all of the above, in which numbers, which proportions? Okay, you get the picture. Complicated. This is a restored crematorium. That's called a cremator in English. I don't know what you call it here. The thing that pushes the body into the oven. The cremator, of course, is not original in the sense that it was never used in Auschwitz. It came from another German camp. What do we do with that? Is that, can we leave it there? And we say, well, this is just to give you folks an idea what a cremator might look like. Okay. But they put it there to show the visitors. Weber comes along and says, listen, you really do need to develop more of the cemetery of this place. You've got far too much information. So this is one of the destroyed gas chambers and crematoria in Birkenau, and they've got all the information on one side, and they finally agreed to put up four tombstones. Oh, success! Success, just in honour and memory of the victims. The trouble is, there's no path to get there, but there are these four. It looks a bit like Stanley Kubrick's film, was it 2004? There it is, these four tombstones. What are they? These are tombstone-shaped objects, and when you get close to them, all it says is, in memory of the men, women, and children who were murdered here by the Germans in 1943, or whatever it is. And why is there four of them? Well, you got it. One in Polish, one in Hebrew, one in Yiddish, and one in English. This is the only thing in the whole museum at the moment, for the last 50 years, to show anything about Jewish identity. Jewish prayer shawls, a collection of talesim. Well, okay, but if you are Japanese or South Korean, even if you're an American, you wouldn't know what a Jewish prayer shawl is. I mean, it wouldn't mean anything to you. But that's all they've got to show that the kind of people who came there. So the ladies don't like it because it's too male. You know, prayer shawls are normally historically worn only by men, not by women, etc. Okay. They found some photographs. Most photographs were pitched when they arrived there. They were searched for all their personal possessions, and all the photos were thrown into the fire. They found a few, and they put them now on display in Birkenau. And they've got brief descriptions. They found out the names and who they are, civil photographs, religious photographs, going to the seaside before the war, Uncle Moshe in a wheelchair, I mean, whatever it might be. It's very moving. And they've actually got an exhibition of ordinary vernacular photographs to give back the identity of the people who were stripped of their identity and murdered in Auschwitz. It's a very interesting, modern, new exhibition in Auschwitz. So I have to say, we're very proud of that exhibition. Plaques. Oh, nightmare. You know, I don't know, Jewish community of Oakland, California decides we would like, maybe not Oakland, California, maybe we'll say Dijon, France, or Szombathely in Hungary, or wherever it might be, we would like to have a plaque in Auschwitz to commemorate our people who were murdered there. So they have committee meetings, what should the text say, which language should it be in, and then finally they get the president of the local Jewish community together, and they all go in a group to Auschwitz and say, we'd like to present you this plaque in memory of the Jews of our community who were murdered in Auschwitz. So the director of Auschwitz comes out, offers them all a cup of tea, thank you very much for coming. Where are we going to put this plaque? Don't know. Know where to put it. Where do you want us to put it? They hadn't thought about it. The Jews hadn't thought about it. We made a plaque. We feel it's our duty to make a plaque. So they got barracks of thousands of these plaques. No idea what to do with them. No idea where to put them. Very interesting problem. I'm just mentioning problems, not, you know. Here were some wartime photographs taken by the SS, which are now mounted in the museum on weatherboards to give visitors an idea of what the place looked like. You can see this is taken at the very spot where these weatherboards are, and you can see that here is one picture taken in this very place of Jews waiting to be murdered. It very often happened that the crematorium, the gas chamber was full, and sometimes Jews had to wait for 3 or 4 days for their turn to be murdered, and they just have to wait in this very wood, because there's a gas chamber in this very wood, and there they are standing around looking completely confused. To me, that picture symbolizes the meaninglessness and the incomprehensibility of genocide altogether. And I like that picture, if I can use that word. You'll notice that the inscriptions below are in three languages, or three blocks you can see. On the left is in Polish, on the middle is in English, and on the right is in Hebrew. You will never find, even your friend who wrote this article in the front page of the New York Times, couldn't bring himself to say, none of these Jews can ever bring themselves to say, thank the Polish authorities for making sure that there are Hebrew inscriptions, the length and breadth of Birkenau, to confirm and reaffirm the Jewish identity of 92% of the victims. Never found, not even this guy, I have to say, terrible. But I'm very proud of that, because my wife and I wrote these Hebrew inscriptions, and the museum were very happy to put them up. These pictures are terribly important, taken by prisoners themselves. The only photographs known to be taken by prisoners of the German concentration camp system. They smuggled the film in. They took the pictures surreptitiously. They are pictures of burnings of bodies in the open air. Why are they burning the bodies in the open air? Because the crematoria were full. The gas chamber had enough space that day, but the crematoria were full. They could only work so many bodies per hour. So they're burning the bodies in the open air, and on the left-hand picture, naked women being pushed into the next gas chamber, the nearest gas chamber here. Then the film, they took the pictures surreptitiously, a very dangerous thing to do, and smuggled the film out of the camp and got it developed and then found it again after the war. Amazing pictures. And we got them on display here. Very good. And then you get the President of the State of Israel. Now you see, he comes along with his great monument saying, my sorrow is constantly before me, written in small letters, and in big letters you can't miss. It says, Chaim Herzog, President of the State of Israel. It's very nice. Well, Poland's very worried about being accused of anti-Semitic or not being nice enough to the Israelis, so they had to put that plaque up. It's the only plaque which is donated by a foreign group, which is up there, and it's outside Block 27 in Auschwitz 1 because there's an exhibition in there of specifically of Jewish victimhood in Auschwitz. It's very problematic, all this stuff. Railway lines have been restored. Mr. Spielberg wanted to film in there, and that's the whole story. I don't have time. I'm going to dash through these because I want to get to my conclusions. And I'm now, I think, on 52 minutes. Problem of visitors leaving candles behind. They like visitors everywhere. You know, we came all the way from Australia, and we want to light a candle for our grandpa Moishe, who we think was murdered in this barrack. So we light a candle, we'll say a psalm, and we'll say a kaddish or whatever, and we leave it there. It's a wooden barrack, right? I'm a smoker. I'm not allowed to smoke anywhere, you know. But these Americans come along and leave candles in these wooden barracks. Can you imagine? Do you know how much money it costs to conserve that barrack, to get that barrack built? They just leave these candles there. So, you know, you've got to pay guards to walk around every 20 minutes and take these damn things away and put the candles out. Okay, get the picture, right. Oh, well, then we've got film crews. Film crews came along and said, oh, we want to do a film, you know, we're very important film directors and we want to do films. So they came, this is the latrine barrack, or one of the latrine barracks. This is where you have your 30 seconds in the morning and 30 seconds in the evening. Don't ask about toilet paper or anything like that. Oh, forget it. The sign up says, Verhalte dich ruhig, keep quiet. Not in very polite German, but it just says, keep quiet. So the film crew, restored it, only they got it wrong. And it's not right. It looks too sanitized. They got permission to film inside that barrack, so they got inside that barrack and, you know, got their paintbrush out and did that. Well, you know, I mean, goodness, I mean, what do you do? How do you scrape that off and restore it to what it was before? I mean, the whole thing's a nightmare. Okay. All right. The problem of religion, belongs to my conclusions, and I do want to say something about conclusions. Problem of religion. This is a building which was built for the commandant of Birkenau, never actually used, but it was empty after the war. So the people of Birkenau, yes, Birkenau's a village, that's why it's called Birkenau. Incidentally, they owned all the land on which the camp was built, and the land was requisitioned from them by the Germans. And after the war was over, when the Germans were driven out, obviously they didn't get their land back because there was this damn broke out a camp built all over their land. And then came a communist government that says, well, we don't believe in doing any of that. We're now communists, you see. And then came the museum, which says, actually, this is a historical place. So until now, which is 2011, they still don't have their land back. And the villagers who live in Birkenau come regularly to our council and start saying, well, you know, what are we going to do, all these visitors and all their tour buses? And we still don't have our land. And we want a place to exercise our dogs. And the very least, we want to have a church. Okay, gave them a church. You know, they're religious Catholics. Why not? Give them a church. So along come the Jews and say, you can't have a church here. We can't have a church here. Why not? Because this is a Jewish place. Jewish place. But what about the people of Birkenau? Well, we don't know about them. We couldn't care about them. And moreover, they say, the Poles helped the Germans to murder the Jews, which is, of course, complete rubbish. The Poles themselves were being imprisoned in Birkenau. And moreover, any Pole who was living within a certain radius of the camp was ordered to leave anyway, because the whole zone, 40 square kilometers zone, special zone, nobody was allowed to live there. Very problematic. All right. Then along comes your friend Elie Wiesel. Now, Elie Wiesel was invited to the commemoration in 1996, the 50th anniversary of the pogrom in Kielce. Kielce is a town in Poland where, after the war, 40 Jews or so were killed by an angry mob. Obviously, no time for me to comment in any detail. I'm just telling you that baseline fact. So they have a service to commemorate these 42 Jews who were killed by an angry Polish mob after the war. So they asked Wiesel, what does he think? And he says, well, it's a funny thing you should mention it, but there are all these crosses in Auschwitz. And you can't have crosses in Auschwitz. You can see them here in the distance there. Chris took it in such a way that the Star of David is prominent, but at the left-hand side there's a cross, and further back there's several crosses. They'd been put there by students who wanted to commemorate. This is a field of ashes, which is one place where the ashes were strewn. He said, you've got to remove the crosses. You cannot have crosses in Auschwitz. Why not? It's because it's a Jewish place. So the Polish government got into a panic and they asked advice from the International Auschwitz Council. Never forget that day as long as I live. Weber stands up and delivers a long, impassioned speech saying, got to respect the Christian dead of Auschwitz. I'm the only independent person on the board. It's a 25-man board, of whom 12 are Polish, 12 are foreigners, and one chairman. The foreigners included the head of Yad Vashem, who said, oh, we don't have crosses in Yad Vashem. We can't have crosses in Auschwitz. Then there was all the foreigners said, you can't have crosses in Auschwitz because you can't have a Carmelite convent in Auschwitz. As you know, there was a lot of fuss over that. It's a Jewish place. You know. Weber says, terribly sorry, but it's not true that it's a Jewish place. There were gypsies there, and there were homosexuals there, and there were criminals there, and there was 75,000 Poles there, and 12,000 Russian prisoners of war, and I rattled all these figures off. They weren't the slightest bit interested. I said, well, how many Poles do you have to have before you can let them have one lousy cross? Go on. I asked the director of Yad Vashem, will you tell me, please, how many Poles do you have before you will agree to them to put up one cross? I was in the minority of one. They said, we're going to remove the crosses. What was never reported, because I had all the press cuttings and New York Times and all that, they never reported it as a consequence of Elie Wiesel's intervention in this matter. They had to remove all the Stars of David as well. So you could have had just as a Elie Wiesel, consequence of Elie Wiesel, all the Stars of David were taken down from the Field of Ashes. It was never mentioned, but of course they had to remove everything. You can't just take the crosses out and leave the Stars of David. They had no religious symbols at all. Okay, right. Okay, must get to my conclusions. I've now spoken for 57 minutes. Terrible. Okay, I asked Chris, please take a picture of grief. He turned up with this. I thought that's great. I wanted one picture to symbolize grief. I don't want to see the face of the girl. It's okay. It's good. Strong. To the point. Concise. Good photograph. Polish memory. It's got a P triangle here. These are Poles who come back every year on the 27th of January to remember their brethren and their friends. Children's exhibition, visited by children in Auschwitz. Terrific. Absolutely terrific photo. Children, we don't know how many. They had a lot of, in the book it tells you, I think they had 35,000 prams, what you now call buggies, you know, for children. People turned up in Auschwitz, were deported to Auschwitz with their children's buggies. And, okay. Israelis. Don't ask me if I can justify to you what a Torah scroll is doing there. I'm not a rabbi, and I'm not the son of a rabbi, and I have no idea. This is religion in the service of politics, is what we would say. That's how I would caption that fact out. But I didn't do that in the book, because my wife, who published it, said, you don't want to upset the Israelis who might want to buy the book, Religion in the Service of Politics. Absolutely dreadful picture, but it's part of the realities, and so I have to show the realities, and that's what I wanted to see. Last two photos. One of these people who come from that group, the so-called March of the Living group, all dressed up, is writing here a little wooden marker, putting a candle, as you can see, yes, wooden marker. And here is, this is the last picture. It's his group. One person puts a wooden marker, 6 million of my people died, 2 exclamation marks. Next one says, in loving memory of my grandparents, Ketty, Nave Felsenstein, and David Goldschmidt, who were murdered here at Auschwitz. And behind it on the top left, it says in Hebrew, in memory of the 1.5 million children who were murdered during the Holocaust by the Nazis. Okay. Do I have your permission for 5 minutes of conclusions? I'm sorry. I really...
Yes.
No, thank you. right. Okay. Just let me give some intro points to this conclusion. I've got 3 points I want to make. First of all, some introduction. Number one, we all know that Auschwitz has to move with the times, that we've got to have new exhibitions. What we've got there so far definitely, desperately needs updating. What I want to see, I think this picture shows a demand for having proper tombstones. We cannot have this. The guards come round and remove all these things and throw them in the bin, just like they take these candles out and blow them out and throw them in the bin the next day. I think there should be at Auschwitz a cemetery, like, you know, you have at Arlington National Cemetery, all these places in America, you know, like military cemeteries. People put up, like in a military cemetery, put up the names of Uncle Moshe, and if he was Jewish, he has a Star of David, and if he's Christian, he has a cross, and if he has nothing, or his family don't want anything, so there's no religious symbol, fine. Let people see a million tombstones, and we don't have to have this ridiculous makeshift nonsense. This is Auschwitz, after all. This makeshift nonsense of wooden markers that just get tossed in the bin, that is not an honourable or dignified way to remember the appalling atrocities, etc., the unspeakable and incomprehensible tragedies that Auschwitz embodied. Right. Second, we need new educational goals. Got to move with the times, and we've got to get beyond the simple information business. We have to think about the causes of genocide, the meanings of genocide. We need to know more about those people who decided to help Jews and protect Jews at the risk of their own lives. Empathy is really not enough for something like this. In the kingdom of death, you have to find the meaning of life. Otherwise, the visit to Auschwitz is meaningless. Maybe we should have exhibitions or things which emphasize that Auschwitz of all places, let us stick our head above the parapet and talk to people about the importance of peace, brotherhood, reconciliation, brotherly love, peace in the world, charity and ethics. That's what Auschwitz means or should mean in the name of those people who were murdered there. That's the message I think we should be giving out. We should introduce more art, more poetry, more music, things which speak to the soul and can reach out to future generations of visitors. And we should cover the post-Auschwitz genocides, Yugoslavia, Cambodia, Darfur, whatever. How to identify the causes of the Holocaust is still a challenge for our historians. I've asked the senior historians in Germany, I've read their books and I've been to their conferences, and there's no question about it. The Holocaust poses insuperable problems for the writing of history. It is a rare case of an event which they've got no idea how to account for. Antisemitism is obviously a necessary condition, but it's not enough. You cannot jump from antisemitism to genocide and say the two things go together. People, you may not like this guy down the road, but you don't go around and brutally murder him and his children and his grandchildren and anyone who comes from his family. It is something much more serious, and it's not clear where this all comes from. So the incomprehensibility of it has got to be built into the model. How do we have a museum which is neither too banal nor too theoretical? Not too preoccupied with the methods of the perpetrators, nor too sentimental in the representation of the agony of the victims, much of which ought to be, surely, be private. Second point, complexity of the memory. There isn't and there never will be a single history of Auschwitz, nor can the memory of Auschwitz or remembrance of what happened there ever be a unified phenomenon. Just like there was a mosaic of victims, Jews, Poles, Gypsies, etc., so too there is a mosaic of memories. I think that Jews are still largely ignorant of other people who were killed in the Holocaust. Don't know enough about it. And that's not good enough, in my opinion. Each group tends to see its own experience, and the Poles are the same, or they had been the same until very recently. Each group tends to see its own experience as unique to itself and to its own history, whereas what Auschwitz should be teaching is the importance of reaching out to others and understanding that there are plenty of other people who shared your destiny too. Can I give you one story? Is it a bit too self-indulgent? Jörn Rüsen, professor of historiography at Bochum, wonderful fellow, tells a story about a group of Jews from Germany, together with a group of non-Jews from Germany who went on a pilgrimage to Auschwitz. And they wanted to have a ceremony when they got there. So they wanted to brought along a wreath of flowers to lay, what's it called, Kranzniederlegung, you know, a wreath, to lay a wreath in memory of the victims. The question was, should they have one wreath, as all being Germans, or should they have two wreaths? After all, there were Jews amongst them and non-Jews amongst them. There's this German, there's this fantastic discussion. Was it one wreath or two wreaths? Who were they? Was the whole group acting together, or should the Jewish participants have their own wreath? Were they sharing the tragedies of the past? Were they wanting to emphasize a difference in the way they related to that past, or were they trying to brush aside that difference in trying to deal with the past? A very good question. I just put that as a question. The question's more interesting than the answer that they found. Auschwitz belongs to many different ethnic histories, national histories, political histories, and theological histories, and it does so unevenly and controversially. Let me just, 30 seconds, tell you about the Jewish responses after the Holocaust. Is man to blame? Is God to blame? Was it evidence of the pre-messianic Gog and Magog before the establishment of the State of Israel? Were the Jews martyrs, or were they just pushed into this against their will? How do you understand this? Was it a punishment for sin, as some people think? The sin of Zionism? The sin of assimilation? Did God just hide his face? Should the museum be saying any of the above, or keeping silent about them? So the point is that what people bring with them, or what the museum might say about them, may be full of contradictions, paradoxes, and conflicting ideas. Should the museum stress the Jewish 92%, or should it really be putting the emphasis on the universal significance of Auschwitz? I mean, so many Holocaust survivors say, we want the world to know about our suffering, but they also say, we want the world to know about our suffering. Well, the people turn around and say, well, what is the world interested in your suffering for? Oh. So we need to do these balancing acts. We need to stress the universal side, but we also need to acknowledge that this place belongs to your history too. The existence of such multiple approaches and elements point to the fundamentally subversive character of the historical Auschwitz. The Auschwitz memory needs to address so many different things at once, both the local and the universal, both the specific and the more general, both one's neighbor and those who are far away, both the names of the individual who are known to have perished, but also an understanding of the wider historical processes which somehow were associated or brought on the catastrophe, both the empirical facts and the philosophical attempt to make sense of the fundamental incomprehensibility and meaninglessness of Auschwitz. What do we do with religion in Auschwitz? Religion, one might have thought, is best suited to convey a sense of the mystery of the place and the dilemmas, the moral and ethical dilemmas that people who lived there had to deal with every day, and all categories of population, the perpetrators, the bystanders, the victims, the rescuers. Let it speak to these moral issues in terms of remembrance. Religion ought to take a much higher profile. But what did religion do? It backed away. We agreed, the bishops agreed, and the rabbis agreed to have no religious symbols in Auschwitz. That is appalling. Religion has backed away. But we still don't know how far people actually turned to religion for comfort and hope, or how far religion was simply abandoned. And if anything, that question is really interesting and really important and can really be helpful for anyone interested in religion to deal with. So, my last paragraph. My own view of these problems, the intellectual confusion, museological tension, and challenges of Auschwitz, is that one should look at all these things positively as a form of organic tension. Think of it the other way round. Surely we would object that if at Auschwitz, of all places, we were presented with one official history, one set of memories to take home with us. Far better to have, I think, the entanglement of voices, a series of paradoxes, ambiguities, a perspective of something which is unfinished, a feeling that we must continue to remain challenged by what Auschwitz was and what Auschwitz means for us today. Visitors, I think, should internalize a profound sense of unease about genocide and its utter abnormality. They need to be disoriented about the basic fact that Auschwitz ever existed at all. It means that they must be encouraged to ask open-ended questions and not just walk out of the place thinking they could tick the box. Been there, done that, and now they know everything there is to know about Auschwitz. It's got to be a life-changing experience. So we, in our generation, need to constantly rethink the strategy, the exhibitions, the presentation of the site, the conservation, the overall policy. And it's likely that there will be many changes in the future, especially in the area of promoting peace and reconciliation between different religions and between different nations. The work of making sense of Auschwitz will be with us for a long time to come. There is no final solution. The work will never be finished. Thank you.